Hello, listeners. I'm Logan McLean, and this is OJT, On the Job Training. It's a podcast where I, a rookie journalist, practice my craft by interviewing passionate people about their projects. Julie Pellissier-Lush is PEI's Poet Laureate, but she's also an actor, a mother, and a proud Mi'kmaq knowledge keeper. Today, we'll get to know Julie's background before getting into life as the Poet Laureate. We talk about her dad's storytelling, other positive role models, and being in a hurry to grow up too fast. And stick around after the interview for this week's progress report about balancing life as a podcaster and working journalist. Julie Pellissier-Lush, welcome to OJT.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's always great to see you. So you're PEI's Poet Laureate, and you've recently gotten a position at the Maui-Omi Center at UPEI, and we're going to get to all of that. I'd like to start with some of your earliest memories of storytelling and kind of how that's been a part of your life.
Well, I'd say my first experiences would be with my father, growing up in Lenox Island, and our favorite and special time was when he had time off from the band office, and we would take a little dory and we'd head over to the Sandhills where it was our time. It was just him and I, and it was a time for us just to be a family and make campfires at night and stare up at the beautiful star-filled sky, and he would tell me stories. Now, later on, he told me that a lot of them he created just from his imagination, and some of them he used from the stories that he heard from the community. But he said that that was one of my biggest gifts, because as he got older, and he had three more children after me, one is 15 years after I was born, one was 17 years after I was born, and one was 21 years after I was born. But none of them, I don't think, got to have that same experience.
So which child were you in that line, sorry?
I was the one who was born with my mother, and then my mother passed away when I was 4, and then we had quite a few years, just him and I, and he remarried when I was 13. So my first little sister was 15 years younger than me. My next little sister was 17, and my little brother was 21 years younger than me.
Okay.
So my son, who I had fairly young, is 2 years younger than his uncle. Or 2 years older, I should say.
I'm sure that was confusing for Richard when he was young.
Yes, uncle, and looking down at a little one 2 years younger than himself was, I'm sure it was.
So what were some of the kinds of stories that your father told you?
He would mostly tell me stories about the animals that we would see during the day, the little mice that run and play around the dunes, the foxes, the owls, and sometimes about the fish in the ocean and all the different things that we sort of experienced at night. And I could see at night that he would be thinking and creating these amazing stories for me that we could share. And he would never tell the same story twice. So you had to really pay attention, because if you wanted it to last again, you had to sort of remind him what that story was. And I learned that very young.
And where did he get this from? Was it something that kind of runs through the family?
Well, my grandfather, my dad's father, was one of the printing editors for a magazine that you might be familiar with, but this was a long time ago, but it was Field and Stream. And it was published in New York, and that's where my dad was born. So my grandfather's first real big job was with Field and Stream, and he was sort of the face of the magazine for a little bit way back when, maybe in the 50s and 60s. And then they ended up leaving New York and moving to Charlton, Massachusetts. My grandmother's aunt fell ill, and they went to help look after her there. But when they were there, then he started becoming a freelance writer, and he wrote for the newspaper in Charlton, Massachusetts, and also my grandmother did as well. And my grandmother's, I think, great-great-aunt is Emily Dickinson. So, I mean, storytelling and poetry okay. Sort of run in the genes.
Wasn't expecting that last part. So when you had such younger siblings, were you kind of taking on that storyteller role for them? Or were you around them a whole lot?
I wasn't as much around them as I probably could have been. At 15 and you're full of vim and vinegar and whole situation with the step-parent, and you're just trying to fit in because as a minister, we moved around quite a bit. I mean, when he married my stepmother, we moved from our little town in Grandview, Manitoba, and we moved to Stony Mountain, and our house was actually probably about half a mile behind the Stony Mountain Penitentiary, which is like a maximum security penitentiary, and that's where my father worked. And so I had to get used to a new school, being in grade 8, and, you know, just changing and adapting to the times. So I think as much as I should have been, I don't think I was around quite as much because I was trying to fit in. I was hanging out with new friends and doing all those things. And then by the time I was 17, when my second little sister was born, I had already sort of had plans of my own and thinking that instead of going to grade 12, it would be much more fun to get a part-time job in Winnipeg, which was about a half an hour drive away from Stony Mountain. So my first job was at Robin's Donuts, where I ended up serving coffee and paying rent to a friend of mine and living in town. So we didn't actually have as much time together as I think I would have enjoyed when I look back. And it makes me sad when I think about it, because I don't know why everybody just feels that they have to grow up so fast. But I was definitely one of those ones who was born with a bit of an older soul and wanted to be independent. And I had a hard time following the confines and constructions that were presented to me. So living on my own and making my own money and making my own decisions was something that I just craved even when I was younger. So having a job, and in hindsight, I think it would have been, my life would have been a lot easier had I just stayed and not going to adult ed every four nights a week to try and get my education and doing it the hard way. But doing it the hard way, I did it well. So I was high 80s or, you know, mm-hmm. low 90s, and enough good grades that I could go to university without being a mature student. Mm-hmm. I could go as a regular student and get my undergraduate degree. I never chose it the easy way, ever. I don't know why. I guess you have to learn the hard way, yeah. and just get yourself stronger.
Yeah, it's the only way to learn some of those hard lessons, I guess.
It's true.
Yeah. So can you just give us a little bit of a rough outline of, you said you moved around a lot between Manitoba and PEI a bit too. Can you give us just the roughest of outlines?
Oh my goodness. Well, I was born in Summerside on a cold, wintry February, and my dad and my mom were driven across the ice because we didn't have a causeway then. We were driven across the ice by Chief Jimmy Sark at the time and got us to Summerside, where I was born. And we lived in what is now the cultural center on Lennox Island. And we had a good little life there. It was still, times were really tough, but it was tough for everybody back then in the early 70s. It was really difficult. You never had enough money to last from paycheck to paycheck. You never had enough food to last, and you just sort of made do with what you had. And then finally, my dad and my mom saved up enough money to buy a little house in Grand River. And then when she passed away, he decided that the only way to be able to spend eternity with her, because in his mind, when you die so young, you really don't have a whole lot of sins, so you're pretty much going to be going to heaven. It's a guaranteed. And he thought, if I'm going to live to be a ripe old man, I need to figure out a way that I can get to heaven too. So he decided to become a minister. And our first big move was to Kingston, Ontario, where he started his undergraduate degree in theology. And there was a United Church minister that had become friends with him over time. And him and I moved in with him and his family. And we stayed there for about 2 years while Dad got his undergraduate degree. And we ran out of money. It was, like I said, it was a really hard time. And so he had enough of his degree that we could move back to PEI for a couple of years and save up more money, but be a lay minister, which means he would have the same sort of responsibilities as a minister, but without his actual degree in it.
Right.
And so his first church that ever he was a minister in was in Dundas. And so we had a little manse there. And the manse was about half a mile away from the church and about
a
quarter
mile.
A manse is where, usually with the United Church and sometimes I think with a Catholic Church, where they know that their ministers, their priests, their religious leaders do not actually get a whole lot of money for what they do. But what they do is they provide them with a house.
Right.
So you get to, don't get to pick it, but I mean, it's been created with the church. So when we got there, we were given this little tiny house with, I think, two or three bedrooms. And it was, like I said, a half a mile away from the church and a quarter of a mile away from the school. And he had three churches that he was responsible for. He had Dundas, and then he had Montague, and he had Cardigan. And he would go to those three churches every Sunday, and he was responsible if any of the congregation members became sick to make sure that he had a visit, or if somebody needed to talk, that he was available for them. And it was an interesting life. Every Sunday, the first service, I would sit through and I'd listen really attentively. In the second service, I'd probably start lip syncing a little bit the service because I knew it. And by the third service, I would be like out and out, just going to town, pretending to be talking like him until he looked down from the pulpit and sort of gave me a little bit of the stink eye, you know, smarten up, Joe.
Now, about how old would you be at this time?
That age, I was in kindergarten, so I guess I'd be around five or six. We stayed there for 2 years, so I remember going to school there for a couple of years, and then we saved up enough money by doing that, because really you're essentially just paying for your food, because you have your house provided
right.
and three different churches. So, I mean, I think he did really well and saved up quite a bit of money, and we went back to Kingston, and this time we rented a little house in Sydenham, Ontario, and it was just off of Lake Ontario. So of course the summers were filled with swimming lessons and boating and camping and going through all these beautiful lakes in Ontario, and my dad's biggest love was taking out his canoe and just stopping wherever, getting into the canoe and just paddling with a tent in the middle, and we'd stop with a loaf of bread and a package of sliced cheese, and we'd be good for a day or two out in the wilderness. And
that sounds lovely.
It was amazing. And those were, like I said, our special times.
Yeah.
And in Ontario, I ended up connecting with my grade three teacher. She had noticed that, because to make ends meet, my dad was going to university during the day. And then in the evenings, he got a job at the Kingston Pen. And so he would go in and be a religious figure in the Kingston Penitentiary. And I'm not exactly too sure, because I was pretty young back then, but I know that he had a lot of work in chaplaincy there.
Mm-hmm.
And that made him some extra money so that we could afford to rent this big, beautiful house. And it was amazing. But my grade three teacher noticed that some mornings I might come in just a little bit late, and some evenings I would just sort of be sitting around and just waiting for somebody to come with me to the house or visit. And next thing you know, after all of that, she looked at my file and she realized, you know, oh, this little girl, she just lost her mother a couple of years ago. She's always looking a little bit sad in the back of the class. And you know, so she phoned my dad up that night, and this is probably just a few weeks into grade three. And she said, you know, Mr. Pellissier, he said, me and my husband, we have no children. And if you would like, we could take Julie on the nights that you have to work at the penitentiary and bring her home, get her supper. She can spend the night because we know you work pretty late, and bring her to school the next day. And so he was just over the moon, happy that somebody had reached out of nowhere and asked to help him out. So then my life just sort of changed. It was after school, you know, my teacher and I would call her for years, Miss Cassidy. I would follow her home, and then she would make a little snack for me to eat, and got to have yummy treats that I probably never really had before. And every Wednesday was Sausage Wednesday because sausages were my favorite meal. And she got her husband to stop because he worked at Alcan in Kingston, Ontario. So he would stop on the way home at the butcher's and get fresh sausages. And she would have the potatoes already starting to boil, and then she'd fry up the sausages. So every Wednesday was a special treat day. So I'd get my favorite meal, and she'd always make my favorite dessert. And Wednesdays became just something I would look forward to. And then actually, if you can imagine, Wednesdays became Thursdays and Thursdays became Fridays. And pretty soon I was just one of her family. And I think it was almost like a year later, I looked at her one night because I would have night terrors quite a bit. And she would always come in and lay down with me and rub my head. And then I would say to her one day, I said, "Miss Cassidy," and said, "how come you never had any kids?" And she said, "you know, Julie, I was just waiting for you to come along."
Oh.
And she took me in, like literally her and her husband took me in. And her life became my life. And March break, we went to Peterborough and we went to the Red Oak Inn and got to go to a great big swimming pool with a little hot tub. And I started getting some problems with my knees because I was double jointed. So I ended up spending quite a bit of time in the hospital. And they were always there, and it was just amazing. And then about 2 years later, I went through grade 3, and then by the end of grade 4, my dad had got his degree, and he couldn't find any churches in the surrounding areas to start his career. And the only church that was available was way out in Grandview, Manitoba. So we packed up the house, we packed up my hamsters, and
that must have been.
It was definitely interesting. And we had two cats. We had a little cat named Sandy and a little cat named Bambi. They were Siamese. One liked me and one didn't. And one of them, just before we were leaving, just disappeared. And I was just heartbroken, thinking that we were going to leave and my cat was going to be left behind in Ontario. And my dad would say, "well, we'll put up notices and the neighbors will keep looking for it." And so we ended up leaving with the one Siamese cat that didn't like me and my two hamsters, and packed up the car. And
do Siamese cats like anyone?
I don't think they do.
Yeah.
I honestly don't. And they were just grouchy. And I mean, this cat liked my dad, but I guess my dad was the one that fed her.
I'm going to need to pause just for a second. This device needs new batteries.
Sure?
Okay. Now we're back. So you had just left that wonderful teacher.
Yes. And we were heading west and heading all the way to Grandview, Manitoba, which was on the sign, it says, the gateway to the west. It was a little town cozied in between the Duck Mountains and the Riding Mountains, and both places my dad loved to visit a lot, so that we would go hiking in the woods and do all those amazing things. But what we found in this tiny rural country town was that it was pretty lonely. It was lonely for him too, as a minister. It was his first church, and people had lived their lives as they always had, and they had their patterns. And when you're new to a town like that, I think it's really hard to try to, make relationships, to try to make connections, because they already have their connections. Yeah. And the kids had grown up together. They had their own sort of common stories that they could share and laugh about, whereas somebody new showing up, it was not the same. And there was a little bit of a hard time for myself with the fact that just outside Grandview, Manitoba was a First Nations community and they were bused into school. So I was almost on this weird line of looking similar to them, but because they grew up together and they had their own friendships and family connections, that I didn't quite fit into their group to play. And then the people in the community who are not Indigenous looking at me and saying, "well, I didn't quite fit into their group to play either." And then being the minister's daughter was just one more little hardship that people had a hard time getting over. And at this point, it was grade 5 and grade 6. And we stayed there for, I think it was 2 years that we lived there. And my dad had made one or two, I guess one major relationship for about a year there. And she had two children of her own. They were John and Jennifer. And as Julie, I became her third Jay. And every once in a while, he would laugh after because I just fell in love with this family, this person where I became so included. It was like I was always sort of searching for that belonging, right? And I tried to find it there, but it was not to be, because once their relationship sort of fizzled out, and he would laugh and say, "I think she liked you more than me at some point."
Did you find you had that feeling with the teacher that you were so close with?
I did. And so I would phone her long distance at least twice a night. If my dad was working and I was alone, I would just literally call her and just start crying and say, "I miss you.
A time zone away.
Please." And then, of course, Christmas time, they flew all the way to Grandview and spent Christmas with us. And then when summer was coming, they talked to my dad, and for a surprise, they got me plane tickets so that I could go back and spend the whole summer in Ontario with them. God. And I got to see all my friends. We went shopping and got my hair done. You know, the whole bit. I got spoiled rotten, and I loved every minute of it. And that just became a pattern of Christmases. They would come to our place, and summers I would go to their place. So we always kept that connection for years and years and years, even up until they'd passed. They were always sort of my rock. They used to call me, ironically enough, their little orphan Anne, and they were my Matthew and Marilla. Oh. Ironically, you know, being from Prince Edward Island, it worked out perfectly for me and my heart, and for them and their hearts. And they did that. They always made sure that I felt still that connection and that belonging, even though I was so far away. And then after a couple of years, my dad met a beautiful lady that he fell in love with, and she was living up in Swan River. I think she was actually in the Paw, and her parents were in Swan River. And they fell in love, and I think they agreed that they should start fresh and start new, not in a really small community. And that's when he took the job in Stony Mountain. So we moved to Stony Mountain. And then after just a couple of years, after they started having babies and a family, and things got a little challenging, as you know, when you're a teenager, you don't really like anybody. So when I turned 17, that's when I decided it was time to move, and I moved into Winnipeg and got a job. And then I decided that was sort of what I needed to do. And instead of, you know, at 18, just thinking of what I'm going to do for college, I was like, I think now I'm ready to go back to high school, but I don't want to go to high school because I never liked high school. It was the hardest time for me there. And yeah, our next door neighbor belonged to the KKK. So, I mean, even when you walked to the bus, it was horrible.
That's wild.
Being there, it was horrible. He did end up becoming, I think, one of the leaders of the KKK in that whole southern Manitoba area. And then I think a few years ago, I ended up hearing that he was murdered or something like that.
But you're going to say elected.
Yeah.
With those guys.
It does. It really does. Like, there was so much hate, and his whole family was like that. And it was really, it was difficult. And being on my own was just so much easier. I had more control of my life.
Definitely seems easier at 17.
It does at the time. So then I decided it was time and ended up going back to high school. But instead of going to high school, I went to adult ed because I felt that was where I needed to be. And so every Monday and Wednesday, I was taking one course, and every Tuesday and Thursday, I was taking another course. So every night I would be there studying and working hard and getting good grades and being able to set myself up perfectly for university, which was awesome.
Do you think like you would have been able to handle the social side of going back to regular high school?
I don't think so.
That'd be so weird.
Like, it's tough hard enough when you're an old soul, yeah, and you're in the space where people are just mean, and they don't give you a chance to show who you are. And no, I don't know. I found it very difficult. Some people find high school engaging and challenging and wonderful. That was not my experience. And so going in as an adult with people that were in their 30s and their 40s was the best thing ever for me. So then moved to Winnipeg, and it was good. It was really good. I loved it there. There was always sort of action, and there was always things to do. And then I met my husband there. And ironically enough, he was from Newfoundland, and I was from PEI, and we ended up meeting there. Mm-hmm. When he was, I think, 16 or 17 years old, him and his friends decided to buy a vehicle, travel across the country, and go meet up with their friends and family that worked in Alberta. Well, the vehicle that they bought wasn't really that good, mm-hmm. so it broke down in Winnipeg, and that's where they ended up staying.
Oh, wow. And a classic story.
It's totally a classic story. And then that's where we met. And we ended up starting a family fairly fast, which is, I think, one of the reasons why I decided that I had to get my grade 12 education. Because after my son was born, my dad's like, you don't want him to get his high school before you, do you? So that really pushed me to try to get it done and done fast. And I did. I worked really hard. Every night I would be at this classes, and then every weekend I would be studying and trying to get it just done to perfection. And then next thing you know, I was all signed up for university. I was so excited. You know, my little man was almost 2 years old. It was going to be the highlight of my life, is being able to enter the university. And I loved university. University had everything that I wanted. It was academia. It was learning. It was doing research in the library. It was all these amazing things that just challenged my brain. Yes, yes. It was just everything all rolled into one that I wanted to do. And I ended up getting pregnant. And instead of going to school in 1992, I ended up having my beautiful baby girl. And definitely wouldn't trade that for anything, but I had to cancel my application and cancel my courses. And then after I had her, then I had two little ones. So I didn't know exactly where to go from there. So I ended up getting a part-time job at a deco company, which was the only thing that sort of worked for me at that point in time. Yes, stickers? We made stickers.
Okay, sounds
and
fun.
And the ones that I mostly worked on were like Polaris, so the snowmobile ones. So
okay.
I would sit there and we would put these freshly printed stickers through a laminating machine. And my job was to separate the sheets of stickers that came through. So I had this really sharp knife that I would always constantly have to use, and you'd have to make sure that there was no little edges on it, because you had to take these big stacks of laminated stickers and put them in a cutter. And if there was a little edge, they wouldn't be able to line up just right, and you would have a sticker that was cut out the wrong way. So anyway, I did that for actually not very long, because I think I had to work from 7 in the evening till 6 in the morning. And so then I would get home.
It's the worst shift I've ever heard of.
It was the worst ever, because you come home and you can't sleep right away because you're hungry. It's almost like supper time in your brain. Uh-huh. So then you eat, and then all of a sudden the kids are starting to wake up and you're like, oh no.
I think that's the shift nurses
work. I think it's pretty
around
much
7 to 7.
Horrible yeah. Shift.
They get paid a lot though for that.
They do. I didn't.
Not enough still, but
not enough, not even half enough. And then I was watching all, because it was like a factory. What I was seeing, what I was witnessing, was that these young men would start same age as me, same qualifications as me, and within a few months they would be bumped up to like manager area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would sort of joke around with the bosses and like, well, when is it going to be my turn to move up into the management area? She said, well, you're pretty enough to get hired, but I don't know. Ugh. It's like, oh,
you're going to have another baby. We can't trust
you. I know. We can't move you up.
Yeah.
So that's when I decided that it was time to go back and rethink the thought of going to university. So I went, re-signed up again, and started in 1995. I didn't know what I was going to do there.
Which school?
Just knew. The University of Winnipeg.
Cool.
And my son actually, years later, decided that he wanted to go back, but he decided to do the University of Manitoba, which is just sort of outside Winnipeg. It's huge. The University of Winnipeg is not so big, which is why I wanted to go there. And, you know, parking wasn't too bad downtown Winnipeg. And there was also sort of a hub, so you weren't too far away from anything being there. So that's why I decided to go there. And my first year, I was, you know, overachieving. I said, I'm going to do this, going to do this, going to do first year of bio. I'm going to do first year of theater. I'm going to do first year of English. And I think I had 5 courses in my first semester. And it just became a blur because you're there Monday to Friday, because I didn't understand somehow how you could loop days together then. So it was there Monday to Friday.
Stack that schedule all on 2 days.
Exactly.
Yeah, you got to get in early for that, though.
You get in early. Yeah. You stay a little bit late, but you can do it Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I did not know the secret to that yet. Mm-hmm. So I ended up, my days were so busy. And then you come home and you're studying and doing papers and doing everything else.
Kids.
And 2 young kids at home. So, I mean, there was really no birthday parties, no doing any celebrations or anything for about 5 years because you just didn't have any time.
Were they old enough to understand what you were doing and why it was so important?
Not really. Yeah. Like, I think my daughter was about 3 and my son was about 6. So, yeah, they weren't.
Richard's just old enough to start hating school himself.
Exactly.
Why would you want to go back to this?
Why would you want to go back to this?
It's terrible.
So I enjoyed it. I really fell in love with it. It started out with me taking business. When I took theater, I ended up doing a play for my final grade, and I picked Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I said, really not the smartest thing in the whole wide world because it was really, you had to stay in character. You had to stay focused. You had to show emotions that I probably wasn't really comfortable with displaying. And I ended up getting a C in my first year theater. And then I ended up getting an A in my first year business. So being as thoughtful as I was back then, I thought, I need to go and do business because obviously that's what I'm good at. So I went and got business. But as you know, business sort of slides into psychology. And so I could have finished in 4 years. But because of the psychology, I really enjoyed it so much that I ended up doing one more year so I could get a double major.
I'm just going to have to take one more pause. I realized I unplugged the wrong thing. I unplugged my freezer, not the fridge.
Oh, no.
Okay. So you were back in school. Where were we?
Yes. We were at University of Winnipeg. And then I graduated.
Business classes.
In business classes. And falling in love with psychology and just really wanting to have both. So I took one more year and graduated in 2000. So all the cards are like 2000, which was actually pretty cool to graduate on.
mm-hmm. The computers didn't even explode.
I know, after 1999. Oh my goodness. And I still remember that New Year's Eve. Everybody was a little worried, but wanting to have fun.
So did you graduate with a double major then?
Yes.
Business and psych?
Business and psych.
Okay.
And they really went hand in hand, actually, when you think about all the different like business and psychology.
Actually, the marketing
and
side
human
of business.
Resources. And
yeah.
So I did that and I really enjoyed that. And after I graduated, my first job was at the Aboriginal Center, right on Higgins in Maine. Nice.
In Winnipeg.
Now, during the day, it's not a bad area. It's not a great area, but it's still not a bad area. Night is not a good area at all. Mm-hmm. The Aboriginal Center was on one side of the road, and the other side of the road was the Métis. The Federation of Métis, Manitoba Métis Federation. And they competed for funding. And when I was young, I didn't quite understand what Métis and status, what the difference really was. So when I realized, well, my dad's French, my mother was Mi'kmaq, maybe I'm Métis. So I ended up going over to the Métis Center and filling out an application. And then she said, oh, so what do you have for ID? And I said, well, I have my status card. And she was like, well, then you're definitely not Métis. And I went, oh? And she goes, your status.
You've already got one.
you already identify as First Nations. We're Métis. And I was like, oh, okay. Took me a while to figure it all out. But I became an employment officer at the Aboriginal Center. And one of the trivia questions I should use at some point or another, I worked on the third floor. And they ended up getting a movie shoot coming to use the great big downstairs, because the Aboriginal Center was originally the train station for Manitoba.
I love something converted into a train station.
Huge.
Aren't they the best buildings?
It was the whole downstairs was like these big, beautiful pillars and huge high ceilings and immaculate marble floors. Like, it was just beautiful. And this movie crew came and scouted it, and they wanted to use it for a movie. And so for about a month, we had Jennifer Lopez, and I can't even remember, I think it was Richard Gere, came and did a whole movie where the downstairs was where they did the dancing and all that activity for that shot. But it was really cool because you could look out your window in the morning and you'd see like their great big caravans of trailers set up for all the high established actors, you know. The people who get a trailer. Yeah.
That'd be so cool to see. Like, not like being given a tour of the behind the scenes, but to be able to actually kind of see it from outside and just
get to watch it.
Just
and
get
then
to
at
watch.
Night, you were like, when you were done work, you had to go down the stairs. You couldn't use the elevators because of the sounds. And you go down the stairs and you're going behind the curtain, so you can see little glimpses of like the film crew and the actors just a little bit as you're walking by.
And did that
and then
give
the
you
security is
an interest in
go.
That kind of stuff?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think that was just amazing. I wasn't like a part of it, but I was around it, which was really neat.
Yeah.
And then we lived on Pritchard Avenue. And then a street behind us had a movie with Robin Williams. So Robin Williams was like in our backyard, pretty much. You could look out your back window and you could see the whole, they took a house. They renovated it to what they wanted it to be. And they did part of a film there with him. And another, you know, you're seeing all these amazing people and they're coming here.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect this in Winnipeg.
You wouldn't expect
it. I know Vancouver and Toronto have a lot of stuff made there, but.
Yeah. Exactly. So it was really amazing. But it was also really hard too. Like, I had a friend of mine from high school, about a year after I left Stony Mountain, she decided to leave, but she didn't leave in a safe way like I did. Like, I went and found a friend, we rented an apartment, I got a job. I did my life that way, and she ended up on the street. And during that time, like in the 80s, mid 80s, there was a lot of our street workers there, just they would be missing. And there was a lot of crime against our street workers there. And there was a lot of them, a lot of young ones. And she would have been like 17. And I remember seeing in the paper a picture of her and I'm going, I know her. And then all of a sudden it says, you know, sex workers, body found outside Winnipeg. And just like, oh. And the fact about the struggles with the Indigenous women there as well. Like, you would constantly hear about them going missing and you'd hear about them being abused. And because I worked in the Aboriginal community there, like, I was working trying to help find employment, or if for employment they needed glasses, I would try to make them, get them connected with a doctor who would help them get them glasses. I mean, that was sort of my role. So I was submerged in the Indigenous culture there. So I would hear the stories and I would know what was going on. And then I think my last month and a half there before I went on maternity leave, we were up on the third floor and there had been a little boy that had gone missing, and he was with his uncle. And we had a community area, access area, downstairs in the basement of this building. They had about 10 computers set up so people could go down there and check their emails. A lot of the homeless people would come and utilize that space. But a man had brought his nephew there and was checking his email, playing some games, doing whatever. And his nephew just went missing. And so we were all told to look around and see if we could try to find him. But a day later, one of the security guards, because it was an old train station, and they only had like a little bit of drywall, but there was still access to the tunnels down there. And they found his body in one of the quarantine cells that were down there. Somebody had seen him just sort of wandering around by himself, and they ended up taking him and bringing him into one of these little quiet cells where nobody would find him. And he wasn't found for quite a while, too. And then we were there when they brought the ambulance to come and take his body out. So, you know, as exciting as it was staring down, looking at Jennifer Lopez, it's like here we are looking at a five-year-old little boy that barely even was like one quarter of the size of the ambulance bed where they were taking him out. And then they had a huge funeral for him. But I just really felt that it wasn't safe after that. Like, you're still coming to that same building and you're just not feeling safe. And then other things started to happen with, as Richard was getting older, his friends were getting older, and there were so many things with gangs there and initiations. Yeah. And they're trying constantly to get these young kids in the North End who were struggling, their families were struggling, and they'd offer them an easier time and more connections and more belonging. So they would easily get sucked into this life, and a lot of them never made it out alive. So my sister came to visit me after I had my last little baby, my little Sean, and she's like, you need to move home, it's time. And this is my older sister, and she was like, it's time for you to come home. And I said, okay. And she goes, there's a job coming up, put your application in. And I was on maternity, I still had like 6 months left of maternity, but I said, okay. So I put my name in, and sure enough, I got a call. Did the interview over the phone, and they said, okay, I think we really want you here, so when can you get here? And I said, well, maybe a month. And so my husband wasn't ready to move because we still had, like, we had a house there. We had two houses there, one that we rented out and we were getting some income from. We had like a trailer out in like Winnipeg where we'd go on the weekends, and we had a really good life. And so he was like, well, why do you want to leave? And I thought, well, I think it's time to try something different. I think it's time for me to go home. So we ended up moving home, and well, first me and my daughter, my little baby, we moved here.
I guess we should specify where exactly home is. It's been moving around here.
Definitely. At this point in time, home was, I had the choice of working in Lenox Island or Charlottetown. And at the time, I decided Charlottetown because it still had a little bit of those things that I enjoyed in Winnipeg, those where you can go shopping, where you can get coffee first thing in the morning.
A little more hustle bustle.
A little more hustle bustle. So yeah, we moved to Charlottetown. And
what was the job you were taking? There.
And I did employment. So it was just basically one employment place and then moved to another employment place. So I had all my skills. I had my training. I had my education. And it was amazing. Our first office was on the Avenue. It later changed its name, but we were right above the mall. And people would come and visit and get help. Work with resumes and things.
So employment is helping other people get jobs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It must have been rewarding.
It really was when you got the right person in the right spot. Uh-huh. And challenging when it's really hard, when you feel sometimes more motivated than they are. And that was in Winnipeg too. And sometimes you're like, you know, oh, this will be the best. And then it's like, I don't really like it. It's like, so you work really hard, right? And you just try to get that. But then after a short time later, they realized that, you know, they were going to be starting a new department in the Mi'kmaq Confederacy. They were going to start communications. And they really wanted to start an indigenous newspaper that would go tip to tip, and they would have it available. I know, hey, and so that's what I ended up doing. I became the editor of the first, well, the one with the Confederacy. It wasn't the first one. The Native Council of PEI had had the Gigmanot for quite a while, which is their indigenous newspaper, but this one was going to be the first for the Confederacy, and so I ended up becoming the editor. And the photographer, and yeah.
As small papers go.
That's how it goes.
It goes that way at the Guardian too, honestly.
Yeah, so I mean, every month you'd have to have a number of stories, and yep. you'd go around trying to get some people to get some really good input, to make sure we had our birthdays covered, upcoming events, and then trying to get ads put in so that you'd get some source income for it.
Yeah, that's the big barge.
So yeah, we did that, and it was awesome. I enjoyed it. It was a really good time.
So about how old would you be at this point?
Oh my goodness. I guess I was about 35 then.
And how old are your kids?
And now Sean is going to be 17 this year.
I mean, at that point, sorry.
Oh, at that point? Oh my goodness. Sean was just a baby. He wasn't even one yet. I had the hardest of times trying to find a daycare that would take a child under one because everybody had maternity leave for a year. So why would they be looking for childcare right. when their child was under one? So I did end up finding childcare, and it was really good childcare. I was still connected with the wonderful lady who eventually did take him in for me. And then Richard moved down next, and he started at Colonel Gray.
He's doing football stuff.
And he did football stuff as soon as he got down here. That was his connection to his friends and to making friends and to build himself up. And my daughter went to Queen Charlotte. My little guy went to daycare. So it was awesome. It was really good. Lots of learning, getting reconnected with family here. Mm-hmm. I have like 16 aunts and uncles and a million cousins and and being able to connect to the elders here. To start learning some of the stories.
And now it's time for the progress report. This is my now monthly reflection on life as the host of OJT, but also as a working journalist. I'm going to focus on that second part today and how it has impacted my role as a podcaster. I'm also looking at how social media and my website are keeping me engaged with listeners while reducing the OJT workload. As you may have noticed, my plan to go weekly has changed. While I'm keeping the deadlines format as a place where I can publish other material, it is not going to be a regular edition, at least not now. I've also changed from biweekly OJT releases to monthly. I simply can't handle doing it that much now that I'm also working. The monthly episodes will be longer, as the editing process doesn't actually take as much time as the progress report, website, social media, stuff like that. I love hosting this show. And it's one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. But after weeks of waking up with anxiety about doing it weekly or bi-weekly, I decided quality and sanity have to come before quantity. The goal of OJT has never been to get famous or have a massive audience. In fact, that idea scares the hell out of me. It's supposed to be a place for cool people to talk about cool things and cool listeners, like you, to join in from outside. And it can still be that on a monthly basis. If I continued overloading myself, though, I'm certain I would just quit. Instead, I'm focusing on what I can do. And that's journalism. Now that I'm actually working, I have other things to offer my small but mighty audience. The platform is already established. Now it's just a matter of continuing to point people in the right direction. I often feel like I'm wasting time when doing social media promotion. It takes sometimes 45 minutes to publish and promote each story, and it can be hard to justify when it's already up on the Guardian website and saltwire.com. But I just have to remind myself of Declan Rockwell, or Liam McVarnick. Listeners haven't met Liam yet, but both he and Declan found me online and reached out to me to be on OJT. They're still two of my best interviews, and the thing I point to when trying to measure success. Numbers don't mean that much when launching a platform in a small place like PEI or the Maritimes. Direct feedback, that's really where you get a sense of how it's going. And I wouldn't have that kind of success without ojtpod.ca, or my other social media activity. I also just think it's important for modern journalists to stay engaged on social media. Sure, it's the most dangerous place in the world for us if we can't keep our mouths shut about certain things. But if you can avoid those things, like, say, arguing with strangers or heckling politicians, it's a great way to build trust with the public. At least, that's my hope. Lately, I've been doing kind of mini progress reports quite a bit on Twitter, where I just share brief stories or reflections on life working. I want the public to know journalists are real people, that we have normal-ish lives, and that we do dumb shit like everyone else. We also have cute cats and delicious cooking. At least I do, and I think everyone should know. Julie Pellissier-Lush will be back soon. You can find her online at juliepellissierlush.wordpress.com. She also suggested listeners check out her theater companies, Mi'kmaq Legends at mi'kmaqlegends.com and Mi'kmaq Heritage Actors on Facebook. You can follow this podcast on Instagram at @OJT_podcast and on Twitter at @OJTpodcast. The Facebook page is OJT On The Job Training. You can follow me on Instagram at logan.mclean.75 and on Twitter at loganmclean94. And finally, listeners, please check out my website, ojtpod.ca, for my written stories and photography. The podcast is available there and on all major streaming platforms. Please rate and subscribe and leave a review. Everything helps when getting a podcast off the ground, and if you like this show and want more interesting guests, listener feedback is the best way to help me reach new people and make that happen. This has been OJT, On The Job Training. I'm Logan McLean. Thank you for listening.